Good evening. My name's Joe. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I am actually surprised that I'm not as nervous as I thought I was going to be. I'm pretty anxious by nature. There's no place I'd rather be tonight, honestly, than speaking at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in a real spot of gratitude today. I just got back from an area that I got sober in, and at one point, and it's where my life really started about 5 years ago, you know. And every time I go up there, no matter where I'm at, it just you know, I get to remember of where I've come from and what you guys have helped me to achieve, and it's really powerful. So. My sobriety date is January 5th of 2012, so if I keep doing what I'm doing, I'm going to have 5 years of continuous sobriety. And, you know, when I got here, I couldn't stay sober. I bounced in and out for 6 or 7 years very consistently. I do want to touch base on what it was like for me, you know, growing up just a little bit, and then I want to dive into what my experience has been in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started drinking and using around the age of 10. I wanted to escape from my home life for as long as I could remember. My mother, bless her heart, likes alcoholic men and still does. But her new boyfriend's actually got about a year of continuous sobriety. So that's very different. My mother has two ex-boyfriends named Robert that have both committed suicide. There were abusive men around, verbally, physically, and emotionally, a lot growing up. So from an early age, I wanted an escape, and I drank, and I started smoking pot, and I loved what it did for me. It took me out of self. I was able to feel comfortable in my skin. And I, you know, I had a lot of stuff, you know, from 10 to 20, like I said, a lot of physical, emotional, and mental abuse from mom's boyfriends, and in my opinion, from some other family members as well. I was sexually abused by two different cousins. Their father sexually abused my mother, my great uncle. So it was just this chain of sickness. And sickness and chaos. I had an absent father. He left when I was about 2 years old. So I always felt really different growing up, and like I didn't fit in, and like I didn't belong, and never comfortable in my own skin. I am extremely nervous, and I've learned that if I say that out loud, that it helps me, that it helps to kind of take some of the power out of it. I started drinking and using at a young age. Towards the end of high school, you know, I was partying a lot, and I had a lot of behavioral issues growing up. This year, actually, in my fourth year of sobriety, I got to finally admit that I have post-traumatic stress syndrome around childhood trauma, which is something that I fought for a long time. Because when I got sober off some old school Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of those guys taught me, you know, what worked for them, which was Alcoholics Anonymous is a cure for everything, and that has not been my personal experience. 18 to 23 years old for me was filled with jails and institutions. I've been to more psych wards, more detoxes, and more programs and jail more times than I can count each one, 10 plus times each one individually. And, it happened really quick for me because I started going at 10. So by the time I was out of high school, I got a decent job. I've always had a little bit of hustle, and I've got some talent. So I started making good money out of high school, and the party was on and continued. You know, but from this period of 18 to 23, everything changed. It got really, really different for me. I, you know, all of a sudden all of my high school friends that were going off to college and doing some things with their lives, they kind of just went away. And they didn't go away. What really happened is I separated from them, you know, and around 19 or 20, I quit drinking at the nicer bars and at the nicer clubs, and you know, and I found myself in East Oakland in the parking lot of bars at 4 in the morning snorting cocaine. Okay, cool, thank you. You know, so the next couple of years was really just like I said, it was a lot of psych wards, a lot of jails, and you know, a lot of misery and a lot of wanting to kill myself constantly. And I would always plan it. I've done things like I've stole money from my grandmother to drink and use. I've stole a gun one time and took it to me with a motel room, and I could never pull the trigger. You know, and thank God I didn't. And what happened is I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys drew me in. I when I got here, I didn't want to be sober, and I wanted the pain to go away, and I met a group of guys that I ended up working for and that I ended up playing carbs with, and we're not real close today, but those guys kept me coming back, you know, and those guys took me to psych wards and picked me up from jail numerous times. So finally what happened is after a lot of in and out and pounding my head against the wall, you know, around 6.5 years ago, I did something different. You know, I moved to this little town in Northern California called Valley Springs, and I went to a sober house, and you know, I quit trying to find another program, you know, and go to rehab because I couldn't afford it and I couldn't get into one, and I got up there and I got a sponsor and I thoroughly worked the steps, you know, and I've had two relapses or one relapse since then, and that was prior to the sobriety date. I quit taking care of myself and made other things my higher power. I'll let you guys ponder on what I made my higher power. So yeah, I want to touch base on the last 5 years. So I got sober again, and what it was different for me. I still had some things, you know, and but I couldn't drink and use like I used to. And my sponsor said something to me at the time that clicked, and it was that, have you ever considered what if? And it was, what if I didn't go back to jail? What if I didn't commit suicide? What if it stayed just like it was right now for the rest of my life? You know, and the next day, or a couple days later, I got up and I started doing what was suggested of me again. You know, and I've been sober since. I didn't count my sobriety date for the first 6 months because I spent a ton of time trying to make up for, like, this fake time that you know, I wanted my time back and not stay in today. So I didn't know my sobriety date for 6 months. Because I would spend so much time obsessing on it rather than taking action to stay sober. The first 2 years of sobriety for me looked like working 60 to 70 hours a week, going to one or two meetings a week, reading the big book a little by myself, running back to where I got sober when things went wrong, and a lot of prostitutes. And that's what the first year, 2 years of sobriety looked like for me. It's funny, you know, I've had people suggest to me not to share those things out loud in meetings and be self-preservative, but my experience has been the more transparent I am, the more people that I can help, you know, and I'm in a place right now where I want to learn to give back more because I still don't know how to, like I used to, and so that's what that looked like. I've had a ton of different sponsors. I had one sponsor that was really, really compassionate, and I needed that from all that childhood shit when I got sober, for him to listen to me and just let me fucking cry and let me heal a little bit. I had another sponsor because at one point I worked this program and I did some NA, and I learned some things that I didn't want around a fourth or fifth step with him. I was having trouble with some jealousy at the time, and I called him and I was having a conversation with him, and I'm doing the work, I'm writing, I'm crying, I'm going to meetings and doing work around this shit, and he told me to I paid for her cell phone, and he told me to go on and block some numbers from her cell phone, and I was like, whoa, I don't think I got sober for that. So you know, I learned some things that I didn't want from that sponsor. I had another sponsor that liked to tell me what to do a lot, and he told me what I needed to do constantly, and I love him and we're still friends, but that also didn't work for me. I have to have some conversation and some understanding in order for me to be willing to take action. And yet again, that sponsor also helped me just to not, just to be a little bit. And with that, I would call him and be like, oh my God, I'm in so much fear. And he'd be like, you don't always have to do a detailed fear inventory around everything. You can just like, you can just stop. And I'm like, oh really? I can just kind of be like that? So that was really powerful. You know, and then my next sponsor helped me to work through some of my abandonment stuff. As well as, you know, kind of accept that I had PTSD with a therapist and a psych. And I've done a lot of work around that in the last year. 2016 has been amazing. It's been painful. It's been fun. It's been interesting. You know, I had a situation where I was seeing somebody and it didn't work, and it wasn't, there was nothing wrong. Like, there was nothing wrong with the situation. There was no drama around it. And let me tell you, that is a miracle. And I want to touch base on this, and I think I'm just about out of time. So,
yeah, you can wrap up.
Okay. So 4 months ago, I bought a bottle, and I was embarrassed to share about it, and I was in pain. My abandonment issues were triggered. And, you know, obviously I didn't drink. That's close as I've gotten to a drink since I've been sober this time. And I had just left a meeting, and I had just dropped somebody else off. You know, and I called some guys, and they're like, well, you know, it's not going to solve anything. And I'm like, I know that. I've been around here long enough to know what a drink's going to do to me. It's going to destroy me. And the reason I didn't take the drink was because, A, like, I don't want to lose everything I've got. I've got a lot today. And B, I didn't want to hurt somebody else and fuck with their sobriety. And excuse my language. That's new for me. You know, before it was F you, I'm going to do this if I'm in pain. And it took me 3 or 4 days to kind of gather perspective from that. And finally, I went to a meeting and I shared about it because I wanted to share hope, you know. And I'm an alcoholic. Like, I'm supposed to drink when I'm in pain. Like, that's what I do. It wasn't that anything was particularly wrong. It wasn't that I was too distant from God. It wasn't that I was too distant from Alcoholics Anonymous. It's that I was in fucking pain and my abandonment issues were triggered. And I loved it. A guy ran right up to me after the meeting and looked at me and he's like, you need to do 1990. You need to work a thorough force. And I'm just like, I'm like, thank you. I'm like, I appreciate the suggestions. I actually don't know if I was spiritual enough to say that day. Anyhow, so it's been a really good ride. I'm really grateful to be here. You know, I'm also a new business owner, which is exciting and scary. And I would like to say that I just went out and did it on my own, but you guys pushed me through it. You guys pushed me through the fear of it. You know, I don't do things like that for myself. I do things like that for other people and run myself into the ground for other people, not for me. So that's been a part of 2016 as well. Thank you guys so much.
Hi, my name is Yvette. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Yvette.
I also have a really bad cold.
Hey, Yvette.
So, if I need to, I'm going to sit down. But I usually like to stand for my sobriety. I know that we have somebody who's relatively new here. So welcome to the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's great. This is the best time of year to get sober. There's no better time. Because there's so many meetings that are happening. There are so many things to do. There are so many places that you can go to support your recovery between now and the new year. And so congratulations for coming into the rooms at a really awesome time of the year. To get the support that you need. And so I want to welcome those that admitted that they were new and maybe some people in the room who didn't have an opportunity to share with us that they're new to the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I also want to take a minute to thank the long-timers. I love it when there's people in the room who were here when I got here. There's nothing like that feeling, that seeing someone who was present and in the rooms of sobriety when I arrive, and who's still here. It makes my heart sing. And it's so good to see both of you. It's just like, wow, you know, long-timers. Now, what would we do without long-timers? I know I would be dead. Long-timers are the ones who keep coming back, for real, right? So, thank you for being here and thank you for continuing to come back. So my sobriety date is 2/22/96, which means I've been here for 20 years. I have a sponsor. She knows I'm her sponsee, and I talk to her on a regular basis. I was in Reno at a women's conference, and I heard this woman say, if you're in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and you are not working the steps with a sponsor, it's like being really sick to your stomach, throwing up, and not opening your mouth. That makes a lot of sense, don't it? So get that stuff out. That's part of the role that a sponsor has in our lives. So I believe in sponsorship, and I do sponsor. I have a home group. My home group is the Antioch Women's Group on Saturday afternoons. And what it means to me to have a home group is that's a meeting that I go to every week, no matter what. I went today. I'm feeling better than I was earlier today. But that's a meeting that I go to that if I don't show up, somebody calls me and I'm like, where are you? They miss me. I give more in my home group. I give more money. I give more time. I give more of everything in my home group. And it's really important for me to have a meeting that I can go to on a weekly basis where I share my recovery and I build relationships with the fellows who are in the room or with the sisters that are in the room because it's a women's meeting. So I have, my experience has been is if I have a home group, I have a sponsor, I have a sobriety date that doesn't change, and I know my name, then everything's going to be okay. Like if I have those four things in my life, then I'm going to be all right. And my experience has been that's true. So I'm gonna excuse me, this is not the best podcast opportunity with me and my sniffle gear here. But I'm going to stick with the format in terms of what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So my first substance was NyQuil. I was a NyQuil abuser when I was 6 or 7 years old. I don't know what was going on in my household, you know, that made it necessary for me to anesthetize myself at that age. But I do remember drinking a lot of NyQuil. And so there are a couple of things that run through my story. One is that I'm a puker. You'll hear about that later. The other is that I'm kind of a scaredy cat. I don't want to get in trouble. Like, I never want to be in trouble. And so even when I'm in the midst of abusing this NyQuil, I remember reading the instructions, and you had to weigh a particular amount to take a full shot, and I didn't weigh enough. And I remember being really pissed off that I didn't weigh enough to follow the rules. I still took more than a full shot, but that gives you a little bit of insight, and that kind of followed me throughout my sobriety. And I remember my mom being like, what is happening to all the NyQuil? And, you know, me never copying to it. I need to invite her to a meeting or just need to tell her, give her some peace, be like, Mom, you're not crazy. I was drinking all the NyQuil. So, you know, you never want to think about your 6-year-old child downing NyQuil. Again, I don't know what was going on in our household, but that was what was needed for me to kind of cope. My father he's the identified alcoholic in our home, and I'm not trying to tell his story, but his alcoholism has a bearing on the way that I related to my own alcoholism. And so what that meant in my household is, so we are a military family, and we moved around a lot, and we always had a roof, we always had, you know, clothes. And when you're growing up on the base, you don't really know. We could have been poor, but you don't really know if you're poor on the base because everybody has the same thing. Everybody shops at the same BX. It's like everybody goes to the same school. So I felt secure in that way. So what my dad's alcoholism looked like was he'd get sleepy. He would just fall asleep in really inappropriate places. For me, like as this, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-old girl, and I have pictures of myself, because I'm total daddy's girl to this day, just curled up with myself, with my dad, and he'd be in the hallway, just spread out. And so why does that matter? It matters because, you know, we had a roof over our head. There wasn't violence in our house. Not a lot of chaos or screaming. It's just my daddy was sleepy. And my mom's a nurse, and so she would talk about my father's alcoholism in a very clinical way. Mm. Your dad has a disease. He's an alcoholic, kind of a thing. And so for me, alcoholism looked one way. Being a drunk looked a different way. Like, that was something else. It took me a long time to accept that I was a drunk. I could accept alcoholism, but I couldn't accept the fact I was a drunk. So fast forward a little bit, again, a goody two-shoes, so I don't drink any of the alcohol that's in our house because I don't want to get caught. But my sister, I have two older sisters, and one of them had this like fabulous Romeo and Juliet breakdancing kind of romance when she was 15 or 16. And so I don't know if anybody in this room will remember, but there was this big craze around breakdancing and, you know, the big hammer pants and the drippy, juicy Jerry curl. And so her Romeo was this guy from Illinois who was like this breakdancing superstar. He was on, like, on the cover of Right On. He was like, whoa. Anybody remember Right On? Am I the only one? It's a magazine. And so I was like, oh! Like, I was so not in love with him because he was my sister's dude, but I was like, I was starstruck. I guess I was starstruck. And so he, you know, I got to be close to him. He do spin on his head. I'm like, oh my God. So he offered me Blue Nun and weed on the same night. And I was like, ugh. And so I remember getting high with him and his breakdancing buddies. I was 11. And what I remember is saying, I don't feel anything. I don't feel anything. I don't feel anything. And then I woke up the next morning. So I black out. I'm a blackout drinker. That's the other thing that's true about my disease. When I woke up the next morning, I don't remember having a hangover, but I do remember feeling like, wow, that was awesome. Even though I couldn't remember most of what had happened, I knew that I woke up feeling like a grown-up and like I got to hang out with the breakdancing boys. So anyway, I couldn't get to alcohol like I wanted to, again, because I knew that if I got into the liquor cabinet in my home, my mom would come for me in a very violent way. So I didn't do that. So what happened for me after that, that first kind of high that I enjoyed, because the NyQuil was like, I don't know what's going on with that. But this thing that I did with my eventual brother-in-law, there was a lot of joy and fun in that. We had a good time, the parts that I can remember. So I was going to school in this little, in Sacramento, and you know, Sacramento is really different now. I went back recently and I was like, wow, there's like things to do here. But when I was there, there was nothing for young people to do. And so I was a smoker and I started hanging out in the smoking section in my high school. And I know for some people that's amazing. Like, they used to have smoking sections in high school. And I found the Rockers. And the Rockers had cares. And anybody could come. It didn't matter. You just put your little money in a little bucket and you could go to the kegger. And so, and nobody like really watched how much you were drinking when you were at a kegger, right? And so like the little thing, the little pump, and like I was just like happy. So that's when my drinking, and so I'm an alcoholic who can admit when it was good. Like there was some good stuff in there. I don't think I would have kept doing it if it wasn't good. And, you know, going to parties, having a better time, you know, being a teenager. And so a couple of things started to happen. One, I believe that we have spiritual awakenings before we actually get sober. That's my own personal belief. And so I'm hanging out with these Rockers. I'm not doing really well in school. And one of the things that had happened is that both my older sister had left home. My mom had gotten back to school and got a professional career. So we were moving from poor, kind of working class to middle class. And so, you know, she had this disposable income. We're going on cruises and trips and doing stuff. We're like girlfriends, me and my mom. And one of the things that started happening is my drinking was causing a strain in that relationship. So my first spiritual awakening happened. I was coming, and to this very day, I don't remember, I was coming home from work. I worked at Rack's Restaurant, and I was really, really wasted. And I was driving, and again, I'm a puker, and so I'm like spinning, and I'm trying not to puke, and I just want to get to bed. If I could just get to bed and not puke all over myself, I'll be okay. And so I'm walking up to our house, and I reach for the doorknob, and my mom opens the door before I can. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, you know the look on her face. I still haven't found the adjective to describe it. It's like a mixture of fury, disgust, pain, remorse. It's like this. And she didn't say anything. She didn't say a word. She just looked at me. And in that moment, I was like, I should stop drinking. And so I did. I stopped. I quit everything. The other part of my story is that I'm a binge drinker. And what that means to me is that I can go for long periods of time without picking up. And for me, a long time is 6, 8, sometimes 3 months, because I did most of my drinking when I was in college and I needed to buckle down so that I could get through school. So I stopped drinking. I did really well in school, stopped hanging out with the rockers, and got into college here in the Bay Area and moved to the Bay Area. And so one of the first things that happened when I came here, after I got settled on campus, this just go out now still, is I went to the DMV to get my driver's license, and they made a mistake, and they put me 10 years older than I was. So remember, I don't like to get in trouble, right? And so immediately, instead of an 18-year-old woman from kind of a podunk Sacramento part of town, I am now a 28-year-old woman with a legal ID that says I can drink in any club that I want to. I'm also on a college campus with a bunch of other people who are 18, which gives me a lot of cachet, right, because I've got this ID that's legal. I still to this very day wonder if they're watching me, like it wasn't an experiment. I've never met anybody else in the room who's made at the DMV put them 10 years older than they were. And if you guys should have seen them when I went to go get it corrected. After I turned 21, they were like, DMV people were running around the office. It was amazing. Anyway, so what that allowed me to do is party like I wanted to, and so I got deeply, deeply, deeply into the club scene in San Francisco. I did all of those after hours bars, the bed, the towns in, all of those places that I just had a good, good time. I had these buddies, and you know, we would party from Thursday to Sunday, and we just we had a great time. But about 2 years in, it started to change. The first thing that started to change is that I was hanging out with lower companions. Like people I was like, who are these folk people? Like you go into their home or you listen to the way they talk to each other and it's just like, man, these are not nice people. Like not always violent, but always not the kind of people I wanted to be around necessarily. And then the places that I was going to, you know, I prided myself on having these fancy drinks with shimmers in them and umbrellas and all that other kind of stuff. And with the, you know, cover charge and standing in line, you know, that kind of clubbing thing. And then I find myself in clubs where there were like bugs on the wall and it was just nasty. And so I'm noticing that this is the way that I'm drinking. And so right about that same time, I was at the Towns Inn, which was an after hours bar, which is now where the San Francisco Giants play, they tore it down. And it was around 3:30 and there was probably 400 of us in this bar or this nightclub. And I'm imagining that everybody who was there was just high out of their mind. It could have not been true, but it's just one of, we were having one of those nights. And I saw a woman get sexually assaulted on the dance floor. And we didn't do anything. We all just kind of watched, like zombies, this woman get assaulted. And as I was standing there watching this happen, I said, you know what, that's going to happen to me if I keep drinking like I do. That was my next spiritual awakening. And so I stopped clubbing. It didn't occur to me to stop drinking. It was like, let's stop clubbing. And so, you know, I'm doing these fancy drinks and all this other stuff, and I just go straight to Cisco because it's cheap, it works, I can do it by myself. I don't have to get in the car because now I'm really paranoid about getting a DUI. I can walk to the 7-Eleven, and it's very economical. I don't know how much it costs now, but at that time it was like 89 cents. So, you know, you could really do a lot of damage with some Cisco. And this is when things started to change for me. This is when it started to get really bad. I started hearing voices on a regular basis. I didn't know it at the time, but I was at the beginning of pancreatitis, which is a nasty, nasty disease that we can drink ourselves into. You don't have to drink yourself into it, but I did. The other thing that's starting to happen for me is that I am full of rage, just rageful, angry, pissed off all the time. I would have homicide fantasies. Like some suicide stuff, but mostly I want to kill other people. I would have just these, I would have these moments. So I would say things like this to people. I would meet them and I would be like, you know what, you're shit until you prove different. I would say that to other human beings. That was the kind of the way that I was moving through the world. And I was living in Montclair in this beautiful house with a party buddy of mine. And I would wake up every morning to these gigantic banana slugs all over my carpet. It was just nasty, right? It was just gross. It was my disease was getting really, really gross. And because I had pancreatitis, I won't go into details, but it was just nasty. There was a lot of nastiness around me. And so because I knew about alcoholism, I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew, right? So again, this alcohol thing. So I still have a job. I still have a car. People are still talking to me. And I'm like, yeah, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not really willing to do anything about it. And what really pushed me into the rooms was physical stuff. I was really, really sick. I was wasting. I couldn't hold water. And so I finally... I got some help, and I went to a treatment program that insisted that you went to Alcoholics Anonymous as part of their treatment. And so when I got to AA meetings, I didn't have the stigma about going to treatment, right? Treatment was like sexy whenever everybody goes to treatment. But I was like, the stigma around AA, I was like, oh God, that's like the loser club. I did not want to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I so did not want to be here. Oh my God, I was like, oh, this is not the place for me. So I would go to meetings late and I would leave early. I didn't talk to anybody. And that went on for a long time. And I continued to do what I had always done, which was binge drink. And they never tested me in the program that I was in. I was in that program for almost a year and a half, and I don't know why they didn't test me, but they didn't. But I continued just to be a binge drinker. And so what happened for me is I met a man. You know, they talk about don't get into a relationship in the first year of sobriety. I am not advocating getting into a relationship in the first year of sobriety, but at the same time, it ain't in the book. It doesn't say don't get into a relationship. And so what happened is I met a man, and when I met him, he had 3 years of clean time. And I knew he wouldn't have anything to do with me if I wasn't sober. So I had been going to meetings for about 9 months, and people had been giving me all these suggestions. Get a sponsor, do this, do that, whatever. I just kept doing what I wanted to do and kept drinking. But when I met this guy, I was like, okay. So I went to a meeting every day. I got a sponsor. I prayed on my knees with a candle in the bathroom. She told me to. I wrote in my journal. I read every piece of literature that was ever written by this by General Service Office. I reached my hand out to newcomers. I did everything anybody suggested because I wanted to be this AA girlfriend. I was just like, that's all I wanted. And so, again, not advocating for a relationship in the first year, but, you know, my higher power knows me and knows me what invigorates me. So I did this for, 3 months. And he dumped me because I was crazy. But by the time I had done all of these things, I had been doing this for about 90 days. And I was like, hey, and my health is getting better. I'm like, I like this. I like being a sober woman. I think I'll stay. You know, I made the conscious decision to stay. I'm hearing more and more in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have the thing, keep coming back. I'm hearing more and more people say, you know, keep coming back, it's nice, but just stay. Don't keep coming back, just stay. And so, that's important. Been important to me. I'm sorry. I need a time check. Start it when it's 9? Stop when it's 9?
You have 10 more minutes.
Okay.
8:55 is when we start.
Okay. So I missed. Yeah, I've been drunk too long. Let me get sober. So, when I got here to the rooms, I understood that I couldn't do this alone. So I, like our other speaker, I had a lot of sponsees at the beginning of my sobriety. I went through 9 sponsees in my first 5 years of sobriety. Because I was clear that sponsorship is not about the sponsor, it's about me. And if it wasn't working, I needed to find a new one. And so I never had a hurt feeling or anything like that about finding a new sponsor. I always just kept looking because I understood I was not smart enough to figure this thing out on my own. And I wasn't arrogant enough to believe that I could just come here and get it by osmosis and not talk to anybody about how am I supposed to do this. And so I finally did find some women that I stayed with for many years who sponsored me in this program. And so what it's like today, I want to spend some time talking about that. So I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. I was telling my husband that this morning. I was just walking around my house and some of the interactions that I've been having lately. It's just oh my God, this life is so good. This is so good. And it's not, you know, because, you know, we're extra special people or anything like that. It's because we have the principles, the traditions, and the concepts working in our home. And so for me, what does that look like today? I'm particularly focused on the traditions as of late. The steps keep me from killing myself, and the traditions keep me from killing other people. And I really appreciate that. As I've continued to be sober, what I needed when I was, some of the things that I needed when I was 30 days sober, I still need today. But more is required as you continue to be here. That's been my experience. And so I think part of that has been me turning my attention to the traditions. And so I'll talk a little bit about that. I'm going to talk about my higher power, then I'll wrap up. And so in terms of the traditions, I really, for me, it's been a lot about unity. You know, on the back of our coins, it says, unity, service, and fellowship. And so, and maybe it's just the kind of the political times that we're living in, I don't know, but it's been really, really important for me to come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and actually make connections with other members. And some people were here earlier, and it's like when I get here, I want to know who people are, I want to know their name, I want to shake their hand. Not only because you're in the room, because you never know who's going to save your life in this fellowship, right? That has been my experience. And so it's important to me that I introduce myself to fellow alcoholics and that I make myself known as someone who is willing and available to be of service to another alcoholic who's suffering or not in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really it changes the way I show up. And it brings more love and tolerance into my life because, you know, let's face it, we're a little cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. And so sometimes people come in the rooms and they're like, whoa. But when I remember the principle of unity, no matter what's going on with someone, and how I may not agree with what they're doing or what they're saying or what their share is, they're a fellow member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to make sure that I make room in my heart for who they are and what they may have to bring to me and what I might be able to give to them. The other tradition that I really like, and there's some people who I shared recently about the third tradition. I really love the third tradition in terms of, you know, our the only requirement for membership is desire to stay sober. Or what is it? Let me read it. Stop drinking. The only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking. So for when I first got here, I had to do that one like on a daily basis, and I still do. I have to maintain the desire to stop drinking, to stay here and maintain continuous sobriety. The other thing that is true is that what my membership looks like today looks really different than it did when I first got here. Like I shared with you, I came late and I left early. I don't do that anymore. I come early and I leave late. There are things that I do inside of the fellowship in terms of service. I always, 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 always have a service commitment. Because what happens, this is my belief, if we don't do service, the fellowship dies. Pure and simple. Because who else is going to do it? Who's going to chair our meetings? Who's going to set up? Who's going to go to the GSR meeting? Who's going to participate in intergroup? Who's going to do those things if we don't do it? And so I just today finished my term as a GSR for my home group. And my sponsor doesn't like when I say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Because I agree with you. Transparency is really important. I hate general service. I don't like it. I don't like the politic of it. I don't, it's boring. We don't share our experience, strength, and hope. Like, that's those reasons I don't like it. But you know what? So what? I'm an adult. I'm a member of this fellowship. And why not me? Who cares that I don't like it? I get to do it. I get to show up and do it anyway and do it with grace and dignity in every single moment. It was a great learning experience for me to be a part of general service. And maybe, who knows, down the line I may change once I'm retired or whatever. I'll be like, oh, general service all the time. Right now, it's like I'm glad this is over. But just as an example of what it means for me to be a member of this fellowship, there's another example that I'll offer is that I go to a meeting every Tuesday that is really inconvenient for me to go to. Really inconvenient for a lot of different reasons, primarily because I'm a commuter. But you know what? The average length of sobriety in that room, it's a women's meeting, is probably 5 years. And so I make it my business to be there as somebody who has a little more time. So if people want to ask questions, they can. I get things, like I need to hear newcomers, so it's not total altruism that I go to this meeting on a regular basis. But for me, as a member who has the time that I do, it's important for me to go to a meeting that's a little bit outside of my comfort zone. The other thing in terms of my membership is that, like, I want to look like I have 20 years. I don't want to look like I got 20 minutes, right? So I show up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm hoping to be and look like the best example of the big book that I could possibly be in that day. That's really important to me. No PJs, like, come on now, put your clothes on. That's important to me because that's attracted to me. Because when we come here, we experience the rooms before anybody talks. It's like when you come into a meeting and it's a glum lot, that's what people see and feel. So when it's important for me as a member to go into a room and spice it up, share my joy immediately. Not just, I may not be feeling that way, but there may be a newcomer who's like, man, this is more depressing, right? We've all been to those meetings where it's like, whoa, who died, right? It's not the meetings that I'm attracted to. I really want to be in a meeting where there's laughter and joy, and the language of the heart is being spoken loudly at the top of everybody's lungs. I see that. I spent a lot of time talking about the third tradition, but I'm going to move forward. The other one that I really like is every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. So we've been going through this thing in our fellowship about, you know, GSO have enough money and blah, 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 right? So seventh tradition is about money. And I've also figured out that for me, the seventh tradition is about kind of how I move through my life. So, again, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. For me, how does the seventh tradition show up in my personal life? Nobody can do my prayers for me. Nobody can go to my meetings for me. I have to do those things through my own contributions. I have to take care of myself through my own contributions. Nobody else can be accountable for that. And when I think about showing up in my life and making sure that I'm doing it by my own contributions, it shifts the way that I think about things. Am I eating right? Am I exercising? Am I doing my prayer? Am I doing my meditation? Am I doing all the things that I need to do to make spiritual fitness? It has been incredibly important. And then I will wrap up by talking about, let's see, just get one. You know, we have a lot going on in our fellowship. I'm losing track of it right now, but around social media.
Attraction, not promotion.
Anonymity. And so, you know, it's been, I think it's an interesting time to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're in this moment in our history where people are freely giving up their anonymity on all kinds of social media platforms. And if you read Bill's writings, Bill talked about how anonymity was like the thing that we needed to guard most closely. And I am of two minds about it. But what I appreciate about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we get to have a conversation about it. Right? And there's no rules or one way to do it or another way to do it. There's definitely a way that I talk to my sponsor and I mentor my sponsees in terms of the way we handle anonymity. But I invite the conversation about breaking your anonymity on these social media platforms. And, like, what does that mean? What does that expose us to as a fellowship, not as an individual? Right? Because we can't do this by ourselves. If the fellowship dies, I know I'm dead. I'm not going to live because I will drink again. And I don't have any doubt that pancreatitis would return. If something else, you know, something would happen that would take me out. So, I didn't talk about my higher power. I can talk about my higher power. So I took 2 minutes to talk about my higher power. So I have I just love my higher power. My higher power loves me. And so there's a sense of comfort and joy that I have in that relationship. The other thing that's true that I've learned in fellowship is that you can't really cultivate a relationship with anything you don't talk to. And so I've developed the habit of prayer because I want my relationship with my higher power to be active. Because there will come a day when no human power can keep me from a drink. And if that day comes, I want my relationship with my higher power to be clear and defined and resilient. And so I spend I spend some time making sure that that's true. And it brings me a lot of comfort because I can always surrender the big stuff. If there's something going on, I just turn over my higher power. I don't figure that out. And my experience has been that my God operates in such a manner that brings ease and comfort into my life beyond my wildest dreams. So it's been a real pleasure to be here. Like I said, for those folks who are newer, I'm really, I'm just honored to be here at the beginning of your miracle. And you're so fortunate to be coming into the fellowship at this time. Because you can get a lot of help, you get a lot of meetings, especially in this area. We're really, really blessed to have literally like thousands of meetings that you can go to on a regular basis. So it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Are there any AA-related announcements?